And you know, the key word here is resistance.
And we only have about less than a minute left, but the Trump's threats to send the federal troops to Chicago, he's continued to back down and back down. Now he's talking about 100 troops. What is your sense of how Chicago would respond if federal troops are sent in?
Yeah, I think, you know, Trump has really done a propaganda war. He's just trying to freak us out. 100 troops, I mean, there are, you know, 3 million people in Chicago. There are hundreds of thousands of people in the Latino community. So we, he's trying to scare us. He's trying to build a lot of fear in the community just to stop us from fighting back. But, you know, frankly, it's not going to work. We're going to go out there. I know he's sending these troops because, you know, we routinely in Chicago have ICE agents surrounded by protesters. We're shouting them out. We're calling them out. We have Congress people, aldermen in Chicago that are standing up to ICE. So he's going to send in these troops. But I think as all of the attacks in Chicago have done, it's had an opposite effect, and that it's stimulating the movement. It's stimulating. There's going to be a protest today at 5 at Trump Tower. And we're not going to back down.
Cristobal Cavazos, want to thank you for being with us. People's Patrol volunteer in Chicago. Thank you very much for being there. Tomorrow we'll speak with Chicago's mayor. Coming up this weekend, I'll be speaking Saturday, October 4th at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco, doing the Q&A after the JFI special documentary screening of Steal the Story, Please, a new documentary about Democracy Now. That's at 4 o'clock on Saturday. And on Sunday, I'll be at BAMFA in Berkeley for another screening and Q&A. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Portland.
All My Greatest Teacher Showed Me Love, a new mental health program hosted by Zan, providing tips and tools along with music, interviews to lighten and brighten in these uncertain times. Join the community every first and third Wednesday from 10 to 11 a.m. only on KBOO 90.7.
All you need is love.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a coalition of Oregon mayors joins together to condemn federal militarization of the Portland metro area. Trump suggests training U.S. military troops on cities like Portland. And in local entertainment news, Live Nation gets its permit to construct a music venue in Portland's Central East Side. Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 30th, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. 17 Oregon mayors issued a joint statement denouncing efforts to federally militarize the Portland metro area. The coalition is led by Portland Mayor Keith Wilson. It includes mayors from Beaverton, Forest Grove, Gladstone, Gresham, Hillsborough, Bend, Lake Oswego, Oregon City, Milwaukee, Tualatin, Sherwood, West Lynn, Wilsonville, Wood Village, Cornelius, and Fairview. The coalition pledges to pursue legal, legislative, and administrative actions to prevent federal military forces from enforcing, in particular, civil immigration laws. The mayors promise their cities won't provide any support of federal military actions. They'll also coordinate across the region and use Freedom of Information Act requests to reveal federal immigration activity. Beaverton Mayor Lacey Beattie said in a statement, quote, "As someone who served in combat in Iraq, I know what a war zone looks like. Portland is not one. Real public safety is built on trust, not tanks. When you bring military equipment into city streets, you don't protect people, you alienate them," end quote. Lake Oswego Mayor Joe Buck said, quote, The strength of our communities lies in resilient neighbors looking out for one another. The federal government may command troops, but the Portland region stands united to command its own destiny, bound by justice, freedom, and the law." End quote. President Trump and Secretary of War Pete Hegseth called a rare meeting of senior military leaders today. One anonymous defense official told Politico that the meeting was, quote, "more like a press conference than briefing the generals. It could have been an email," end quote. In his remarks, Trump mentioned Portland and Oregon Governor Tina Kotek. Trump said, quote, "How about Portland? Portland, Oregon, where it looks like a war zone. And I get a call from the liberal governor, 'Sir, please don't come in. We don't need you.' I said, 'Well, unless they're playing false tapes, this looks like World War II. Your place is burning down. I mean, you must be kidding.' 'Sir, we have it under control,' I said. 'You don't have it under control, Governor, but I'll check it and I'll call you back.' I called her back. I said, 'This place is a nightmare. It's one of the worst. It's brutal.'" End quote. The tapes Trump is referring to are likely old protest clips from the racial justice demonstrations that took place in Portland in 2020. Portland Police Chief Bob Day echoed that at a press conference yesterday, saying the president is likely seeing footage from 4 or 5 years ago. In Trump's speech to the generals, he also talked about the National Guard deployment in U.S. cities having a bigger purpose. He said the DOD, quote, "should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military," end quote. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield filed a motion for a temporary restraining order against the federalization of 200 National Guard members. The first hearing in that case is scheduled for Friday. As for when National Guard troops might be in Portland streets, it's harder to say. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Bomar is the Director of Public Affairs at the Oregon Military Department. He indicated National Guard troops were called up to protect federal facilities and support law enforcement and could be ready by Thursday. But Oregon leaders haven't heard from the federal government about when the troops will arrive. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson said, quote, "The question is, are we flying blind? This deployment isn't something we asked for. The federal government is days away from closing, and we have a deployment that, if it occurred, has no mission. We have soldiers that wouldn't even earn pay," end quote. Israel agrees to a tentative peace deal for Gaza. Democrats and Republicans brace for a government shutdown, and NYC's Department of Corrections has violated the city's sanctuary laws. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I believe that today we're taking a critical step towards both ending the war in Gaza and setting the stage for dramatically advancing peace in the Middle East.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is praising President Donald Trump for a plan to end the Gaza war. Provisions call for Israel and Hamas to release all hostages and prisoners and for Gaza to be governed by a transitional, technocratic, apolitical Palestinian group, which would answer to a committee Trump would chair. If Hamas doesn't agree to the plan, Trump has pledged to fully support Israel's continued attacks. Almost 2 years of conflict has killed nearly 70,000 people, mostly Palestinian women and children. Republican congressional leaders say the government's headed for a shutdown with hours left to reach a deal to fund the government. Democrats are demanding Medicaid cuts made in the unpopular budget megabill be restored and Affordable Care Act insurance subsidies be extended. After meeting with them, Vice President J.D. Vance accuses them of using their leverage to make drastic demands.
"You don't use your policy disagreements as leverage to not pay our troops. Now, don't say the fact that you disagree about a particular tax provision is an excuse for shutting down the people's government."
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the $1 trillion cut from Medicaid and the millions of consumers who would be priced out of Obama health coverage require immediate action. Schumer says he's not sure the president is aware how serious it is.
"Closing of rural hospitals. The fact that so many clinics are closing. And I don't know if we knew this before, but the fact that people will pay $400 more a month, close to $5,000 more a year on their health care premiums."
While furloughing federal employees would be the usual step in a shutdown, Trump is calling for agencies to consider mass firings in an effort to cut federal spending. Some Democrats say they also want to protect Congress's power of the purse from executive overreach, while the Supreme Court has expanded the president's power to not spend money Congress has appropriated. And a separate fight is brewing over housing funds. The administration is trying to reshape a Department of Housing program which funds low-income support programs. Advocates want lawmakers to include a no-cost provision in either a continuing resolution or the agency's budget, ensuring existing grants are renewed. As the White House prepares to send National Guard troops to defend ICE actions in Portland and Chicago, immigration agents are being accused of aggressively arresting innocent people in mass raids. The Trump administration has long touted the sweeps as targeting the worst of the worst, but data show most people detained have little to no criminal record. Governor J.B. Pritzker says what President Trump is doing isn't making Illinois any safer.
They're not targeting violent criminals or gang members. They're arresting tamale vendors, delivery men, and shaking down families.
Meanwhile, New York City's Department of Corrections has been found in violation of the city's sanctuary laws. A new report alleges a corrections investigator working on a joint task force with Homeland Security gave information to ICE, which is barred by local laws. Murat Awada with the New York Immigration Coalition calls that inexcusable.
New York City's long-standing sanctuary policies and laws are public safety measures that ensure any New Yorker, regardless of immigration status, can interact with our public institutions and report emergencies to authorities.
I'm Edwin J. Vier for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Today is the last day to take advantage of a federal tax credit of up to $7,500 for buying a new electric vehicle, which is expiring early as part of the Trump administration's new tax and spending law passed in July. Electric vehicle advocates say losing the incentives will slow what they see as the country's inevitable shift away from gas-powered cars. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
It is National Drive Electric Month, but Oregon drivers who don't own electric vehicles face a setback as federal tax credits expire today for buying an EV. The credits of up to $7,500 for new EVs and up to $4,000 for used models are ending early under the Trump administration's One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Oregon has a burgeoning EV industry with one of the highest rates of EV drivers per capita in the country. The bill also scrapped federal fuel economy standards. Ingrid Malmgren from Plug-in America says these credits and standards have been a driving force in the transition away from gasoline vehicles.
The policy changes that we're seeing are largely going to undermine industrial progress in the United States, particularly in battery manufacturing, clean energy manufacturing, and automotive manufacturing.
Investments in EV manufacturing have created more than 230,000 new jobs across the U.S. so far, according to Plug in America. Opponents of the EV tax credits say they've been costly and ineffective. Malmgren points out that more than one in four new vehicles sold around the world is electric, and that number is likely to increase. She says rolling back clean vehicle standards and incentives puts the U.S. at a disadvantage globally.
We are not going to be leaders in this space. We are going to lose out on technological innovations, and we are going to have to watch the rest of the world move forward and possibly be buying our vehicles from other countries.
Despite the challenging policy environment, Malmgren believes the shift to EVs is inevitable.
They're just superior vehicles. They're quick, they're clean, they're quiet. They offer so many benefits over gas vehicles.
For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Music promotion company Live Nation got their permit for building a new concert venue on the Central East Side. It's a controversial project. Locals, led by music advocacy group Music Portland, have pushed back. They say it's bad for Portland's music scene to allow such a large company, a near monopoly, to get a foothold in Portland. Live Nation owns Ticketmaster and is being sued by 40 states, including Oregon, for violating antitrust laws. Others have worried about the impacts on pedestrian safety since it's planned for Southeast Water Avenue in close proximity to the train tracks. The Land Use Board of Appeals allowed the construction to move forward in June. The permit shows a plan for a two-story building that will have a maximum capacity of 3,500 people. There's plan for a mezzanine, food services, artist locker rooms, a loading dock, and artist lounge. The venue is expected to be open next year. It's the second concert venue being developed in Portland right now. Monkey Presents is building their own at the Lloyd Center Mall at the site of the former Nordstrom. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with some rain showers and an overnight low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 63. Today in history, in 1960, The Flintstones animated sitcom premieres on TV. It was the most successful and longest-running network animated series for 3 decades. The quote of the day is from Nobel laureate, writer, and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, born this day in 1928. He said, quote, "The opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. The opposite of art is not ugliness, it's indifference. The opposite of faith is not heresy, it's indifference. And the opposite of life is not death, it's indifference." Today is Orange Shirt Day, also known as National Truth and Reconciliation Day, honoring survivors and those lost in Canada's residential school system. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's National Truth and Reconciliation Day, also known as Orange Shirt Day, honoring the survivors and children lost in Canada's residential school system. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, on the eve of the day, a multi-million-dollar settlement and an apology were announced for one northern school.
The agreement in principle is aimed at compensating the former students of the Isle of Cross boarding school, just under 300 miles north of Saskatoon.
Simply put, these schools were a mistake, and they shouldn't have existed.
The Premier of Saskatchewan, Mo Scott, went to the community on Monday.
Today, on behalf of the province of Saskatchewan, I apologize to you. And as part of this agreement, the province has agreed to pay $40.2 million to address the 4 major pillars of compensation under the class action that was filed.
The compensation, Mo says, is an effort to promote reconciliation, healing, wellness, education, language, culture, and commemoration in the community of Isle of La Crosse. The residential schools operated across most of Canada from the mid-1800s to the late 1900s in an attempt to assimilate First Nations, Inuit, and Métis children into white society. It's believed about 150,000 children were forced to attend the schools. Thousands were physically, emotionally, and sexually abused. Many died. The Saskatchewan government expects the proposed settlement will be approved by the courts by early next year. I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Interior Department has reversed a Biden administration decision to give Alaska tribes legal jurisdiction over Native allotments. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the order could return millions of acres of land to state control and shut down the Acluna tribe's new casino near Anchorage.
This latest federal opinion attempts to restore a 1993 Interior Solicitor's opinion issued during President George W. Bush's administration. It gave the state jurisdiction over Alaska Native allotments. But last year, the Interior Solicitor in the Biden administration, Bob Anderson, issued a new interpretation of that decision. It gave jurisdiction over Native allotments to the tribes, which cleared the way for the Acluna tribe to operate a small casino on a Native allotment. Last week, the Trump administration's Deputy Secretary of the Interior overrode Anderson's opinion and instructed all department bureaus, including the National Indian Gaming Commission, to follow the 1993 opinion. Anderson now lives in Anchorage and is a visiting professor at Harvard. He says the reversal of his decision is wrong, that Native allotments in Alaska should be regulated by the tribe just as they are in the lower 48.
It's been the law in the lower 48 forever, and Alaska's part of the United States, and the same federal laws apply here as they do everywhere else. So I'm fairly confident that we'll continue to prevail on these questions.
In April, the state of Alaska sought an injunction from a federal court in Washington, D.C. to shut it down. So what happens now that the Interior Department has revoked tribal jurisdiction over Native allotments in Alaska? The state has not said what its next step will be. Patty Sullivan, communications director for the State Department of Law, said the new opinion calls for the Interior Department to reevaluate actions taken by the National Indian Gaming Commission. Alaska's Attorney General Stephen Cox applauded the decision and said it restores jurisdictional balance that Congress intended. But despite last week's opinion, the native village of Aklutna said its Chenan Gaming Hall remains open. The tribe's president, Aaron Leggett, said it will also review the opinion to clarify questions of legal jurisdiction. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Memphis resident Sabrina Butler Smith is the first woman to be exonerated from death row in the United States. She was convicted as a teen for her infant son's death and later cleared in 1995 when evidence showed he died from a hereditary kidney condition. Now Butler Smith is speaking out against the death penalty. Danielle Smith reports.
As Tennessee resumes executions, a death row exoneree is raising concerns amid growing debate over capital punishment. A study estimates more than 4% of death row convictions are erroneous. Sabrina Butler Smith is the first woman to be exonerated from death row in the United States. She was acquitted of the murder of her infant son in 1995 for a tragic incident later found not to be a crime. Butler Smith will share her story today at the Justice Without Execution Forum at Rose College in Memphis. She explains her son died of a hereditary kidney condition.
My son had health issues. He had heart, kidney, and lung problems. And when my son stopped breathing, I didn't know how to apply CPR, and I tried to apply CPR with someone telling me what to do. Well, I feel like I didn't apply it right. They took that, turned it around, turned it into a murder.
Butler Smith notes more than 200 people have been exonerated from death row in the U.S., raising questions about why execution continues. Since her release more than 30 years ago, she has spoken in churches, schools, police academies, and legislatures urging reform. According to data from the ACLU, Black defendants are nearly four times more likely than white defendants to receive a death sentence. Butler Smith says she was sentenced in Mississippi on March 13, 1990, with an execution date set for July 2nd, making her the youngest person on death row at 19. A new attorney took her case to the U.S. Supreme Court, which overturned her sentence. She was retried, and hospital records revealed her son's underlying health condition.
So I ended up altogether doing 7 years altogether, and it was horrible. But I just don't think we as a people have the right to decide who lives and who dies. I just don't.
Butler Smith believes her case was racially motivated. At tonight's Justice for Execution Forum, Butler Smith will join Cynthia Vaughn, whose stepfather Don Johnson was executed in Tennessee in 2019 for the 1984 murder of Connie Johnson, Cynthia's mother in Memphis, and the Reverend Stacy Rector, the executive director of Tennesseans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Danielle Smith, Tennessee News Service.
A new study finds many amphibians may be imperiled by climate change. Heat waves and droughts seem to be pushing more amphibians towards extinction. Dr. Anthony Lisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. From poison dart frogs in the rainforest to common fire salamanders in Europe, many amphibian populations are declining due to threats like habitat loss and disease. But a new study indicates that many amphibians may also be threatened by global warming.
Climate change is becoming a more pressing issue for amphibians.
Evan Toomey of Goethe University and his colleagues found that over the past two decades, amphibians in areas that have experienced more heat waves and droughts were more likely to have been pushed closer to extinction. Heat and drought can affect amphibians' unique biology.
Many frogs are breeding in very short lives, temporary ponds, and so like if you have an intense drought at the wrong period of the year, you can have catastrophic loss of an entire cohort of amphibians.
Toomey's research shows that amphibians in places like Madagascar and Brazil's Atlantic forest region may be especially threatened by climate change.
These are some really species-rich areas where heat waves and droughts have increased a lot in recent years.
More than 40% of amphibian species are now at risk of extinction. And as climate change brings more severe droughts and heat waves, amphibians may face increased threats. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now we go to Global Citizen Commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says President Trump will do anything to avoid criticizing or taking action against Russia's Putin or Israel's Netanyahu. Trump may not realize or acknowledge it, but he's being played, with the result that in both the Ukraine and Gaza conflicts, peace is a very long way off. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. One cannot examine the wars in Ukraine and Gaza without noticing certain parallels. First and foremost are the human and economic costs of aggression. Those costs are staggering, and how they might be made up is anybody's guess, since the aggressors, Russia and Israel, are not going to pay. And the aggressors happen to be led by people judged war criminals, Putin and Netanyahu and their inner circles, another parallel. But in this episode, I want to focus on Donald Trump's role in these conflicts, specifically how he has been played by Putin and Netanyahu again and again, with consequent damage to any chances of a peace agreement in either conflict. Poland's foreign minister said in a PBS interview, quote, "I think it's high time that President Trump should see that Putin is mocking him. Instead of a ceasefire that was supposed to happen before the Alaska summit and serious peace talks, Putin is sending more and more drones, first at Ukraine and now at NATO," unquote. Indeed, Putin has been mocking Trump from the moment Trump took office. As the CNN contributor Fareed Zakaria points out, Trump made, quote, "preemptive concessions" to Putin long before they met in Alaska. Russia would probably get to keep what it had conquered. Ukraine would never become a member of NATO, the U.S. would not send in troops to guarantee Ukraine's sovereignty, and Trump wouldn't re-engage economically with Russia after the war, says Zakaria. How many times has Trump said he is disappointed with Putin, is concerned about the losses of Ukrainian lives as the result of Russia's bombing of civilian targets, and is ready, in about 2 weeks, to do something about Russia? Never happens. Worse yet, Trump has enabled Putin's war by leaving it to the Europeans to come up with weapons and plans for defending Ukraine, and by dismantling a whole range of U.S. government programs designed to track and upend Russian disinformation efforts. In short, Trump refuses to consider Russia an adversary, despite its maximalist demands, giving Putin every reason to push the envelope. 19 Russian drones crossing 300 miles into Poland is a particularly aggressive push. It tested NATO's response, which proved excellent, and tested Trump's response, which was so weak, the attack could have been a mistake, he said, and he's not happy about it, that even some Republicans in Congress were exasperated. Trump will try every way possible to avoid confronting Russia. When a journalist prodded him at a recent news conference to talk about sanctioning Russia, Trump angrily replied that he was, by sanctioning India with high tariffs for buying Russian oil. "I haven't done phase two yet, or phase three," he added. The other day, Trump said he also wanted sanctions by the Europeans on China. Well, there is no phase two or phase three, and NATO members aren't going to impose high tariffs on China. You can bet Putin, reading Trump's comment, had a good laugh. Then there's Trump and Netanyahu, a parallel case of defiance of Trump and a weak-kneed Trump response. As I discussed in my last commentary, Trump has outsourced Gaza policy to Israel. Netanyahu is free to do whatever he chooses in Gaza, knowing that the U.S. will not stand in his way. The Israeli attack on Hamas headquarters in Doha, Qatar, is a telling indication, much like the Russian drone strike in Poland is. Both were met with Trump's equivocations. Here is Qatar, home to a major U.S. airbase and over $1 billion in U.S. investments, and a co-sponsor of Israel-Hamas peace talks, coming under attack by Israeli jets. And here's Trump, who says it is his peace plan that awaits Hamas's approval, doing nothing to obstruct Netanyahu's path. Qatar condemned the attack. Trump said he was very unhappy about it. Netanyahu could care less. His plan is to sink Trump's plan, lay siege to Gaza City, force the Palestinian population to flee, and expand Israel's occupation. Now the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is saying that a diplomatic solution on Gaza may not be possible. My guess is that he's echoing Trump's private thoughts. Why is Trump so easily played? First, he sees more disadvantages than advantages to confronting either the Russians or the Israelis. If it's the Russians, that means investing far more than Trump wants in Ukraine's defense, with the outside possibility of being dragged directly into the war. With the Israelis, confronting them seems to put Trump on Hamas's side. Second, Trump admires authoritarian leaders. On the rare occasion when Trump says he doesn't like what they're doing, he can barely hide his admiration for their audacity. Third, there's the Nobel Peace Prize thing. Trump desperately wants to be acknowledged as a leader for world peace. He seethes over the fact that Obama was awarded the prize. And fourth, Trump is not very smart. He probably won't admit to being played because that would mean he's been outsmarted, which is inconceivable for a stable genius. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 30, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Anna Wilcox and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, and Danielle Smith. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuchner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gasco. We are heading east today. So Oregon's Blue Mountains encompass some of the most beautiful landscapes and habitats that you'll find anywhere. Within the Blues 15,000 square miles, you'll find Oregon gems like the John Day River, the Eagle Cap Wilderness, Hell's Canyon, and a surprisingly large percentage of Oregon's forests. But because they are geographically isolated from major population centers, they often don't get the recognition that they deserve. And that remoteness all